Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show this week. We have two amazing sponsors, Environments for Humans, our longtime sponsor promoting the CSS DevConf out in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, kind of near Denver at the Stanley Hotel this October 21st through 23rd. In-person conferences, you know, they do a lot of over-the-air conferences, too. This is an in-person conference. Check out CSSDevConf.com and another conference the month before at BlendConf.com. That's coming up September 5th. 5th through 7th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Three tracks, 40 talks over the 3 days, and save 20% off that one with coupon code SHOPTALK at blendconf.com. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hello, you are listening to the Shop Talk Show. I am Thor from Isengard.
And I watched Avengers this week. How's that? I've been working on my Thor accent. Anyway, I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer. Hi.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening this week. We have twice the number of normal guests this week. Literally double for your money. We have the two, and when we're doing this, and also a shop talk first, is that we all happen to be in the same house except for Dave. So who's with me is Tim Sabbat and Alex Vasquez. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us, guys.
Yep.
Yeah. Tim and Alex and me work on CodePen. We are Team CodePen, and is a three-person team, and it just so happened with all of our yeah. It just so happened with all of our schedules that we could be together at my house here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So we've been hanging out for the past few weeks and having fun working on CodePen, mostly the last one, but some of the first two also.
So you guys are all in. You're like, do the kids call it code jamming? Is that what you guys are doing?
Yeah, I would say there's some jamming going on.
That's good. That's good. So who, I guess I'm curious because I don't work at CodePen. I'm a user. Who does what? Tim, what do you kind of do at CodePen?
So, I'm all around dev. I'll do whatever is necessary, but I've got some specialties, of course. I do a lot of our scaling stuff with AWS and like set up all of our systems. And, I write some Ruby code and some Node code when required, and I can do front end code, but that's kind of like more the specialty of the other two guys in this group.
Cool. And then Alex, that puts you.
Yeah, I'm kind of more of a front end specialist, even though we all kind of are a jack of all trades at CodePen. My big project at CodePen has been the JavaScript heavy pages. Like the editor, and then just anything Node.js related. This is my first Node.js project, so it's been pretty fun and a little frustrating, but that's kind of my forte right now, is the JS.
How's Node been for you guys? Like, and we had Raquel. Yeah. Velez on, and she was talking, she kind of gave us the rundown on Node and whatnot, but like, how's that been working for you guys, like in production, live, hundreds of thousands of users a day kind of thing?
Right. It's been a little bit of a struggle, honestly. Getting Node, first of all, I have to couch it with it's my first Node.js production app. So that brings its own issues. But just being able to monitor Node itself is great. The core of it, it's JavaScript and it's easy to understand from that perspective. But doing that in a backend environment really kind of flips your mind around, and having to structure code in a format that is, I've never been forced to structure my actual logic in a format that mimics the way it executes. And that's been kind of a little bit of a been difficult to kind of deal with, but I've found some libraries like Async that have really helped that. Monitoring Node is still kind of tough. It's such a new project that you don't have all the great tools that you have for something like Ruby on Rails to monitor the performance of it and kind of understand what's going on with it. So we're still kind of feeling that part out. But it's gotten a lot better, but it's gotten a lot better after like 4 to 5 rewrites of the collaboration code.
Right. From a systems perspective, like being responsible for like monitoring and keeping the server up, there are definitely some things that happen with Node that are just completely irregular. You know, like we'll run up CPU for no apparent reason whatsoever, and it won't happen in correspondence with, for example, memory increase or anything. It'll just suddenly, you know, it'll run great for 10 days and then suddenly just start doing something oddball. We've got systems in place to check for that, but, you know, and basically restart the process when that happens. But I can tell you there aren't a lot of great tools out there for monitoring Node right now like there are for, you know, Ruby. For example, we use New Relic to monitor the Rails stack, and it's great. You know, it gives you incredible insight into what's happening. For Node, the product there for New Relic is so beta that they don't suggest using it in production. So, you know, we're kind of just going with whatever console output that we get from AWS, and that's not always the best.
That's wild. That's cool. That's good to know.
I mean, Node is used for like if you're familiar with using CodePen, if you're using something like a preprocessor and you like stop typing or something in there, it will grab the SCSS code you've written or the less or whatever and send it back to our servers and have it be preprocessed and come back with the actual CSS or JavaScript or HTML or whatever it is and then dunk it right in the editor. So that transfer happens over Node. Yeah. And then the collaboration and professor view modes we have for pro users, like I'm typing and you're typing and we're both typing in the same editor and we can see each other as we type, kind of Google Docs style. A lot of people are familiar with that. That happens all over Node too. So if you're wondering like what parts of CodePen are in Node, those are the primary bits.
So the screenshot service also runs over Node as well. We use Phantom.js to capture a screenshot every 3 minutes, you know, screenshot every 3 minutes after a pen's been saved so that we can use that elsewhere. And that Phantom.js is obviously a Node project, and we use Node to sort of control that as well.
Yeah, so Phantom is like this headless WebKit kind of thing. So you can be like, give me a screenshot of this URL. And I'll be like, here you go. You're like, oh, awesome, thanks. We haven't used it for a lot yet. If you subscribe to any of the RSS feeds for something like the popular stuff on CodePen, there'll be images in there now that show you a representation of what it looks like, which makes it went from the RSS feed being kind of boring and useless to being totally interesting and cool, I think. So that was a big thing. And now we have this. Now, since every pen has an image associated with it, there's all kinds of cool stuff we can do with that. We just integrated this thing where if you're looking at through the forks of people that have forked your pen, it's a little hard to know if they've done anything interesting with it. So we just have it now if you roll over the fork. Which is actually a little broken this morning. I'm going to fix it. It'll show you a little pop-up image of what the fork looks like. So you can roll over like 10 of them super quick and see if anybody did anything particularly interesting. That's all the kind of things we can do now that we have an image of every pen, which is cool.
Yeah. Cool. Well, it sounds like you guys are, you know, making some sweet improvements as well to CodePen. So I'm looking forward to all the improvements, and I probably want to personally apologize because anytime it like breaks, it's probably me just raging on code so hard I just break the system, you know. I don't know if you guys saw it, but I recently created an excuse generator, which no doubt millions of hits.
Pseudo random number generation is tough. No, that's all client side stuff. I'm sure you know. It's not a big deal.
Oh, okay. Well, but when I typed it out, it was really painful.
Yeah. We felt it, Dave. We felt it.
Yeah. There's a little blip. In you. Is that what you call them, blips?
Yeah, extra servers now.
Yeah.
Deploy. Yeah, Tim just finished some cool stuff. You know, Tim often jokes about how, like, when he does work, there's not a lot of, like, community clapping and stuff, because you don't see a lot of what Tim does. You know, like, this auto-scaling stuff he's been working on. Like, when our traffic goes way up, she's got a bunch of cool code in place that, like, spins up new servers and deals with the traffic, and then when the traffic comes back down, they go away. The kind of the goal being that we're only paying for the servers that we need at the moment while keeping the site super fast. And nobody really cares about that, you know? It's just the site works, but it's actually, like, super interesting work. And Tim recently got that all blogged up. So,
cool.
Check that out.
There's a question in the chat room about the database on CodePen. Are you guys flat file, or are you, like?
Well, it's up in the air. I think Tim could talk about that.
Yeah. So right now it's all MySQL, but okay. We're getting to a point where we're kind of outgrowing the single instance that it's running on. So we're actually, as it turns out, the size of the DB is 98% the pens table. So what we're talking about doing, pens are the result of saving your work. So what we're talking about doing is moving the pens table out to MongoDB, which is, you know, better capable of scaling, in a sense. So that would end up making our DB size very small on the MySQL side. And then just when we need to basically grab, you know, just pens, for example, we can call out to Mongo and grab in the information that we need, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, for example.
That would make sense, because you guys are literally storing documents, you know, like micro documents.
Right.
So, and these would just be...
And
the document database.
Exactly. And there's no size limitation per se on those. And so, for example, there's a pen out there called Mona Lisa and Drop Shadow or something like that. And the size of it is pretty huge, and it's one of our largest forked pens. And that pen alone takes up a pretty big chunk of our DB. And so rather than trying to continually scale out MySQL, the idea is to just scale out the parts of the parts of the site that are sort of cumbersome.
Hmm. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
I'm like, good luck, man. I'll be right there rubbing your shoulders.
Just providing some support. I'm very interested. We'll have to catch up later, but we should get moving on. But I want to hear more about the intimate code pairing that you guys do at CodePen, interlocked legs and all that. So Chris, this week.
A little drama heavy. I thought it was light, and then now with your list you put in here, I'm like, oh, what am I talking about? This was drama heavy.
This week got a little serious on the hot drama. So I don't know if you guys heard this one, but Expression Engine recently went up in flames. No, it recently, it is, can we say that if it's hot drama? But they post, so Ellis Lab, who makes Expression Engine, wrote a post on called Competition Ethics and Add-ons on their blog. And oh boy, you might remember the Noah Stokes episode we had. We talked a little bit about Expression Engine, or a lot about Expression Engine, and a little bit about Craft CMS, which is kind of like that one plugin developer went off and like started his own kind of CMS, right? The main plugin developer for EE kind of spun off his own thing. Well, Ellis Lab posted on this. Did you guys read this, Chris? Did you read this?
I did. So the deal is, they had a conference. Dude who made Craft CMS, who used to be a huge Expression Engine plugin builder, comes there and he's like, I'm going to introduce Craft CMS and I'm going to do it on stage at EEE conference. And EEE is like, no, you're not. You know, that's a little weird. Anyway, so then they posted this big blog article and I don't know. Are most people on the, like, EEE was being dicks about it, or are they on the side of I don't know. You're not supposed to say that, right? I'm sorry.
Well, it's sort of like this one thing, right? Like, I think I didn't realize the guy had done that, like, on stage. He's like, like rage quitting, you know, and pitching his own CMS like as a competitor at an EE conference. I think that was maybe kind of silly, but at the same time, they like spent this whole post to basically just like slander this dude or something. And like, they like on their company blog, and then they're like, you know, they're basically like, so now we're rewriting all his plugins and we're putting them into core or something like that. So you don't have to use his plugins anymore. Like, that's kind of the thing too. Like,
so that's pretty, yeah, there's definitely bad vibes on both sides here, huh? I mean, I could see not wanting, you know, if I threw a CodePen conference and somebody's like, I built a CodePen competitor, can I come pitch it at your conference? I'd be like, absolutely not. You know, we can be buddies. There can be competition in this market, but you're not going to announce it at my conference. It's just it's just stupid. No, you can't do that. But at the same time, if we're like, oh, I see you have some interesting features here, we're also going to steal all those and make them free or something, that would be rude too. So it's just rude compounding upon rude.
$120 undercut, basically. Like, they're like, boom, undercut.
Oh, wow.
Massive. But that's another like criticism the developers have had, is like EE's a little stagnant, and like, and so that's why this dude made this whole other CMS, you know. Yeah. And it's just
the blog post, I would never write that either. That just is,
that's where like the that's where it gets weird. I don't know. Maybe you guys have a CodePen blog. Would you like whatever?
No.
Talk
diss somebody in public on it? No.
Yeah, just like whatever. Start making fun of like JS Fiddle or something. I don't know. Like whoever your competitor is. I mean, like, you'd never do that. Like, and that's really bad form, right?
Right. Yeah. You want to keep it above board.
Yeah. It just never ends up being a winning proposition for the company. You're never going to come across as the intelligent one that's above it all. I think you don't want to be involved in something like that. When someone pulls a stunt like that, you should just kind of let it be. He's a new competitor and he's much smaller than you, and people are going to sympathize with him a bit because your engine is stagnating a bit. But posting an entire blog post and also writing all of his software for free, it's going to come across as a dick move to everyone, to the general public. So not a great move on their part.
Yeah. No, this is sort of like, if there's smoke, there's fire, you know? So I don't know. I would be very careful if I was using EE right now. IMHO, Noah Stokes. Okay. Well,
in other news, Firefox 23. There was all the articles that are about this. The point is, there used to be a button in there where you could just be like, "Don't run JavaScript" or "Disable JavaScript" or whatever it is. It's just because you should have the option as a user to turn off this stuff for security reasons or whatever. And then there was an often quoted blog post that was part of all this drama that says, that was titled something like, "There's a button in Firefox that ruins the entire internet." You know, it was a good post about UI and how, like, if you literally check this box, which, you know, there's lots of people that use Firefox that have no idea what that box is, that may end up in the preference area just clicking stuff to see if they can get something to work or whatever. If they click disable JavaScript, man, does the internet get ruined. And I think Firefox probably read this blog post and probably agreed with it, sort of, and just said, hey, we're going to get rid of that. No longer can you disable JavaScript in Firefox 23. Is that entirely true? Or is there some way to do it? I guess you could use a plugin to do it, right?
Like a JavaScript, like you do like in console. You'd have to open console, which is weird, but and like manually hack it. So if you've disabled JavaScript in the past, you now have no way to enable it again, which is also kind of funny. It's like permanently disabled. I don't know. This is sort of like the big question is, like, are we headed to a JavaScript required internet in the future? What do you guys think? You guys obviously employ quite a bit of JavaScript on CodePen, so I know what you guys think, right?
We're gonna actually turn on a mode where you can turn off DOM rendering and just use JavaScript. That's all we're gonna do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, as a JavaScript developer, I sure hope we're headed towards that future. I mean, I just read a presentation that said anything that can be done in JavaScript will be done in JavaScript on the web. So
yeah.
I don't necessarily know the original use case for like why you would actually want to turn off JavaScript. I feel like you may want to be using a different browser other than Firefox for that purpose, something in the command line. So I agree. I actually think that's kind of a useless button, in my opinion, for Firefox, especially when they put so much effort into making their JavaScript engine so fast.
I used to listen to Security Now a lot. I still do, actually. I really like that show. And Steve Gibson on that show would for a long time, like kind of touted the you should not run JavaScript in the browser kind of stuff and only in whitelist enable it on sites and stuff because it's so dangerous. And I'm just not sure how true that is anymore. So Tim and Alex and I all worked at Wufoo back in the day, who sponsored this podcast in the past. It's a form builder. I'm sure most of you have heard of it. We would literally, if there was no JavaScript on the page, there was a no script tag at the bottom and it popped up this huge overlay modal that said, this site just doesn't work without JavaScript. So if you want to build some forms, just go ahead and turn JavaScript back on. We all three of us worked at SurveyMonkey as well. I'm not sure exactly how they handle that, but I'm 99% sure the site doesn't work at all without JavaScript. And now we're at CodePen, and we do the same thing Wufoo does. I put a no script tag at the bottom that just says, look, this site's going to be freaking useless without JavaScript. So, you know, instead of just letting it be broken, we have a little stuff in there that says, hey, you know, I see that you have JavaScript turned off. This isn't going to be a good experience. I'd rather do that than tell, you know, just have it be like crazily broken.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, I hope we're going to an all JavaScript web. I think it's weird to have it off.
Yeah, I think it's one of the core building blocks, right? Like, in the potential of JavaScript is huge, but I also sort of live in the like progressive enhancement world, and like I tend to empathize on the like Node.js user side of things, just because we tend to get really aggressive and really sloppy, you know, when we're doing, that's maybe a overgeneralization. I mean, but
content-y sites, I would go there, but I don't feel, you know, and you can disagree with me, but I don't feel particularly guilty about not making CodePen more Java. I mean, it's the core experience,
right? Like, applications seem like the break for possibly requiring JavaScript, right? I don't know. That seems.
Yeah, but, you know, then people argue, like, what's an application these days?
That's a good one.
Is Facebook an application?
Oh, boy.
Anyway, that's the drama there. And then there was a Zakis article about, like, enough with the JavaScript or something. Did you click through
that
slide deck?
Yeah, he posted, Nicholas Zakis, SlickNet on Twitter, posted a, like, enough with this JavaScript already slide deck. And I think that was from a talk like before Firefox stuff came out. So they're kind of paired or whatever, but like, I think it's, he makes a good, his argument is like, we are trending too heavy on making JavaScript kind of do everything. When the whole kind of deal there is that, we're trending on making JavaScript do everything when, you know, we could be just doing regular progressive enhancement and it would be working fine. It's interesting. But I've also like been following, or I watched this Yehuda Katz talk on, which sounds like a fake name, but it is his real name. Yehuda Katz. He's talking about just like Angular and stuff like this. And he's talking about how like the, how everything, the W3C moves so slow that like JavaScript and all these frameworks, like with non-semantic HTML and stuff like that, are actually the only way to kind of push the web forward in a serious way without, you know, without having to like deal with the W3C. If that makes sense, like you have to kind of just take two steps forward in order to have a working concept that you can then write into specs and backfill. That's kind of what.
Yeah,
that,
there was a recent article on CSS Tricks I just posted about Hitch.js, which is a framework for doing that. Be like, you can, you know, they call them prolyfill, which is like, okay, the W3C is talking about this, but it's going to be a long time till we can use it, or the discussion is stymied because we're talking about it so theoretical. theoretically, this Hitch.js allows you to kind of create, you know, kind of, you know, polyfill a selector that doesn't exist, but it probably will exist. You know, I think that's the idea there. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, check out that article. It's pretty interesting.
Yep.
There was, you know, Eric Meyer had a talk called like JavaScript Will Save Us All that had a similar kind of vibe to it. You can just do a lot more with it.
Yeah, I read the Zakis slide deck last night. That's the one I was just talking about. And I like what he's saying, but one of the things that I think is really key is having a budget for how heavy these pages are. That's one of the points that he was making, that it's just you're loading megabytes and megabytes of JavaScript. So I like that perspective. I still think JavaScript does lead the way. It's kind of the front runner and letting us create really like vibrant, exciting, rich experiences on the web. So from that perspective, I think Yehudacast has got it right. You know, we can't wait for a new HTML tag to come out and natively be supported by the browser. But I definitely think JavaScript is the future for pretty much everything. I mean, you see all the front end frameworks these days. It's everything's just getting more skewed towards the JS.
Yeah. I probably, when the day is done, I'm still more of like a conservative, like purist, but I'm starting to sway. I don't know. All right. So the last thing worth mentioning is Google Reader is now dead.
Officially today. So yesterday it was up with the thing, but today you go and it's just down, down, down. So
yep.
Farewell.
I got my, there was this trends link that you could go to. I had read 299,991 articles on Google Reader, like 9 away from 300,000 headlines.
That was in yours?
Yeah. Wild. In like 4 years. So too bad.
I was interested in the people who were like hanging on till the last second and then worried about it. When I heard they're going to shut down, man, if a service tells me they're going to shut down, I'm out.
Yeah. You know?
So I was out day one. I was like, you're shutting down? Let me, I'll evaluate some alternatives and just switch right now. I tried a few things. You know, I use Reader and I just like, I ended up with Feedly. Mm-hmm. Feedly was right on the floor below us when we worked at SurveyMonkey. So we would see them in the elevator and stuff. I'm a little worried that they don't have a business model. I'm a little worried that they don't have any export, but they seem to be going strong and they seem to be like soliciting feedback in the right ways and stuff. And I quite like the design of it. So I'm going to stick with them for a little while, I think.
Yep. Well, cool. News and links. Just one real quick. HF and J fonts are now available as web fonts.
I was in their beta for like the last 6 months or a year or something, and holy cow, they're so good.
It's good. I find it I'm very happy about this. What I found very funny was in the marketing materials and stuff, they're like, look how good this font looks on the web at 9 pixels, right? Which I was just like, that's so cool, it does look really good. And then I was like, why would you ever at 9 pixels? That's like, I mean, but I guess that's the stress test. It's
right. Cool, it's like, look at how good my speakers sound at like 50 decibels or what. I don't even know if that's a measurement, but it's like, if they sound good that loud, they sound really good more quietly too.
Yeah. That was just interesting. I'm excited though.
It looks like they did a really good job. The website looks super beautiful, and it looks like they're really generous with what, you know, like if you've ever bought any of their fonts before from the website, which I have, like all of them, I think, that you can just use them on web projects for free and pick an additional 5. You know, the pricing looks pretty reasonable. I think they're gonna make a few bucks on this one.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure it disappoints quite a lot of people that they didn't just pair with Typekit or something, but this is, you know, it's kind of like, I'm surely we'll make a lot more money doing it this way.
Yeah. Well, shall we get into the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk Show? The question.
Sure. answers. Let me do a sponsor real quick. So yeah. CSS Dev Conf, literally, there's no dashes or anything. CSS Dev Conf is October 21st through 23rd. Zoe Gillenwater, Ben on the show, Eric Meyer, who we really need to get on the show, as I love Eric, Nicole Sullivan, Jonathan Snook, Estelle Wild, Tab Atkins. Five out of six of those people have been on the show before, so you're familiar with them. All legends in their own minds. Just really actually CSS legends. Including a Smacks workshop by Jonathan Snook. If you want to go, and me and Dave have said this before, that these conferences is so fun because it's so focused on one topic, just really nerding out on just CSS. This is the place to do it. So it's just outside of Denver at the Stanley Hotel in Colorado. Check out CSS Dev Conference. Put it on your calendar. That's what you really want to do, so you just don't forget about it. Or you could just straight up buy tickets now. They're available. So go to that. It's an in-person conference by Environments for Humans, Christopher and Ari, super great people. They normally do those online conferences, but this one is an in-person conference. So it's going to be awesome.
All right.
Potatoes time, Dave. Question and answer.
James Kusachi writes in, what are your thoughts on mod page speed? Being able to minify assets, reduce requests, optimize images, etc., without really having to do anything other than install and configure it definitely sounds like a plus for front-end development. Having used it, I really like it. Sure, there are pros and cons as well. I'd love to hear your input on it. I love the show, guys. Keep up the good work. Guys, Tim and Alex, have you guys ever used mod page speed? What are your thoughts?
So there was a discussion about whether to include that. You know, we use GitHub issues, and that kind of popped up in there. And some of the stuff is definitely out of my league. You know, I talked with Alex and Chris about these types of things, and I was like, should we install this as an Apache module? And the answer kind of came up that it wasn't. Yeah, that it wasn't really necessary per se. You know, Alex was like, I run, you know, YSlow and a bunch of these other type of analysis tools on our website, and I think we're doing all these things already. And then, Alex, I think you can chime in. There was some more technical reasons for it as well, right?
Right. It's interesting because it seems to do so much, but I think most developers that are conscious of kind of like the performance, especially for the front end, like serving up a single JS file, single CSS style sheet, or at least combining those so that you're not serving up, you know, 10, 12 different files at the same time. That said, I'd still be interested in running that on CodePen and just testing the performance of it to see if it improves. Because it seems like we're doing everything at the moment, but it actually would be interesting to test the performance of what they're doing versus what a developer who would manually go and curate each individual JS file and make sure it's combined and take all the CSS files and make sure those are combined and that they're being served with the right cache headers and all those things and they're being gzipped and things like that. So we already all do those things, but I'm really curious to see if they can even improve on top of that. I'm a little skeptical of blindly having something concatenate all my JS files and having debug any issues that come up. So it's something where I would be pretty conservative about because I like the control that I get from doing it manually.
Looking at it today, they did say 40 configurable options. So apparently through that module, you can do some fine tuning. But yeah, I see what you're saying. It's kind of a dangerous proposition to just turn it on and say we're good to go.
Have you ever used it yet?
You know, I use it once, and I'm no server wizard, right? And it uses an insane amount of memory. Like if you had 4 gigs of memory on your server or something, it will use like 2 gigs of it. It occupies extreme amounts of RAM. And like, so we were having issues, like our server would just fall over.
And if you bump the top of that, that's not helping. That's hurting your speed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, cool, all my sites are very fast until I get a single bit of traffic and then the server just falls over. But it's possible, right? Like I did something totally wrong or it's, I don't know, but I tend to lean more on like a Nginx varnish approach, I feel like that would be a, I don't know, a heavier, dutier. But, you know, if versus doing nothing, I think you should probably do page speed. But that was my loose opinion.
All right. Well, that's good. I like Alex's pragmatic approach of like, well, we look through, you know, like this is what I would do is I would look through the list and be like, we already do this stuff. We don't need this. But of course, the pragmatic answer is maybe you should try it and see, you know? Yeah, I don't know. Who knows if you're.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get installed and going. I mean, it should just be like a yum package or whatever. Or an apt-get, and then it's just one line in your HTTPD conf file.
I mean, we would do it on staging or whatever, you know. It's not like we would risk just putting it out there and seeing what happens, you know.
Just going for it. Yeah, I think do it, but yeah, James, I would try it out. It's nice, but make sure you load test it. The memory thing was the biggest thing for me. It was just like,
We frankly couldn't survive that. We run these boxes pretty close to their memory ceilings. Like right now, a push will actually put us in a swap occasionally. So like the idea of adding anything on top of that, you're right. I think I would rather move to Nginx over the Apache server before I started doing anything that sort of risked us blowing out any more memory.
Right. And yeah, because you can just, I mean, you can set 100 servers in front of your server to kind of minimize load or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, all right, cool.
You've never made it to 100. That's a little high, Dave.
Oh, really? I'd be doing. I'd just be spinning up servers, going out of style.
One server per visitor.
Yeah, I'd just be like, you get a server. You get a server. Everyone's working on their own, like EC2 box, basically. all right.
Jason Dreisener asks, where would you start a major front-end design project for a new software-as-a-service website? We're using Node.js in the back-end. I'm setting up Grunt with the standard minifying, concatenation, SAS Encompass. Do you have any tips on making this workflow more awesome? Tips on starting the front end design for this kind of project. So I like this idea. Like you're standing at the foot of a mountain and you're like, this is software as a service. It's probably going to have tons of views. It's going to be a very complex-ish front end. You already know what you're using on the back end, although he says just Node.js. And that seems like you're probably not just using Node.js, right? We talked even in the Raquel episode, it talked about how Node is usually part of a larger backend stack. It's not, you know, Node.js isn't probably serving your like actual pages, I would think. Although I have seen like a blogging engine on it. It just seems weird. Anyway, what do you think? You know, you're like, you're standing at the foot of this huge new thing. What workflow stuff can you do to make sure you're doing it right from the onset?
I don't know. I think his Grunt, like getting everything on Grunt and some sort of pre-processing across the board is very smart.
And probably like, you know, haven't you talked, Dave, about like delivering mini bootstraps and stuff? You should probably start thinking about that pretty early on instead of just
Yeah, like Brad Frost has that pattern pattern lab, and it's this idea of atomic design that everything is a reusable piece of code that goes down the assembly line or that can be built up into larger Lego constructions. I would definitely do that. I mean, if you have no design or whatever, I would just maybe like start figuring out what components you're going to have. Like, obviously if it's an app or a software as a service, you're probably going to have a button somewhere. So like try to figure out how you're going to code your buttons and class your buttons and do all that. If you're going to have probably a form, so you'll have to figure out what forms kind of look like. You're going to have errors and successes and exactly. You know, validation. And then the next one you're going to have like, you know, what they put into a form is probably going to show up in some sort of index of things. So now you're going to have to figure out what the index of things looks like. I would hope you're working with the designer on some point of this thing, but maybe you're not. Maybe you're super lean here. yeah, I don't know. I think you'll want to just kind of figure out what you're going to have, how many views you're going to have to deal with. Take an inventory of kind of where you're headed and how much tech debt you've got yourself into. That's my biggest thing now is technical debt. People just kind of add too many features and then they're just like sort of pinned down by all that bad ideas. Right? That's a thing. Alex?
Right. I mean, he's got like so many decisions to make, and you definitely want to be super conservative and go kind of with a tried and true. If you definitely want to have something that's software as a service, my advice is always to be really conservative with the tools that you choose and make sure that they're super mature, because you're trying to sell software, and one of the number one features you're going to need is reliability. So standardize on a lot of like tried and true technologies. Whether if you're going to go with Backbone and stick to it 100%. He's got like a lot of those kinds of decisions to make. I'm assuming if he says he's using Node.js, he's probably using something like the Express Web Framework and things like that. So I would honestly, I would start looking at what tools are usually come together with those things. Like, what is the best front end web framework that works with Node.js Express? You know, where do you have the best examples if this is your first project? Those kinds of things. What are you most comfortable with? Like at Copen, we go with a style that we're very comfortable with that we've developed other applications in. So we get to focus on solving the problem and not look at, we don't necessarily have to worry about the technology that just kind of melts into the background, because in the end, our users don't truly care what we use to create our product as long as it's reliable and we get to develop rapidly. So I'd make those kinds of decisions up front and kind of stick to them.
When I first read this question, I thought you're using Node.js in the background, but you didn't mention, you know, like if it's all Node or if there's something else that kind of is dealing with your, I don't know, the more traditional parts of I don't know, what's serving up pages and stuff. And I was like, so if you're using Python, perhaps, because he's specifically asking about workflow, well, maybe whatever those other backend technologies can help guide what your workflow is like when you're working on the front end. For example, I'm sure Python has some kind of, you know, asset management tool or something. Rails certainly has a couple of choices. There's, you know, you talked about Yehuda. He's got some like Rake-based asset thingy that I think is largely what the asset pipeline does, but more in some way. We use the asset pipeline. What's that?
Oh, keep going. Sorry, I just had a thought.
Cool. We use the asset pipeline, but we also, I just kind of have been, I had it set up and then I busted it, but I got it set up again, was Guard, which is Guard is like a file watcher thing. And there's another new thing called Watchman that's out that does this too. But Jason is a front ender and he's talking specifically about workflow. So definitely check out Guard. I think it's kind of nice. It's kind of like a code kit kind of thing, in that it watches this folder for you for changes and then automatically injects those changes onto the page using the live reload browser extension. And that's really nice because, you know, I love using CodeKit, but I use CodeKit mostly on my kind of like personal projects and stuff, and these like larger chucked in huge framework projects that I work on really need something kind of built into the project, and that's what I use Guard for, and it's been kind of awesome.
One thing I was just gonna say, and that stuff sounds awesome, because we talk a lot about like CodeKit, but that's very like high end, you know, not deep in the app kind of stuff typically. But I was going to say, you might want to think about approaching your app in the like Karen McGrain kind of way, where your app is actually just an API that you get information out of. And your website like is something that hits the app, like makes requests back and forth from the app. Like they're on two separate servers. And that sounds a little weird, but if you can decouple like your front end and how people interact with the app from the back end, I think
then we all go to a bongo party and sing Kumbaya.
Was that? Is that? I know.
It just sounds too good to be true.
No, I just that's like the holy grail of apps, right? Is like totally decoupled. But like, I think if you can do that, that would be ideal because you're not going to hold up the back end by something you're not doing on the front end or whatever. You can just say like, hey guys, add this in there. And they'd be like, yeah, okay. So that's my thing.
I mean, a word on that, complexity really does kind of kill. So when it's difficult enough to get sort of like your front end code talking with your back end code. And when you add another stack to that, right? So like you make your call to your front controller or whatever, like your web layer, and again, you're calling to a backend layer. Each one of these has a protocol it needs to talk over. You're making HTTP requests. I mean, if we're talking about workflow here, that's the holy grail. But when you're just starting something out, I feel like the best bet is to just reduce complexity as much as possible. You know, you want to basically try and get things going. Your users don't care if you have, you know, they don't really care if you have this sort of like really complex backend. You just want to basically do what's going to deliver a website to people. So keep it simple, I guess, would be my suggestion. I kind of cringe when people start talking about getting overly complex with the backend right away.
Yep,
that's good. Cool.
BlendConf is coming up. It is a generalist conference in Charlotte, North Carolina, featuring 50 speakers, 40 different talks over 3 days and 3 tracks. Tons of stuff there. So if you kind of want to go to a conference where you're a web person, but you know, maybe you want to bring your whole team, back-end people, front-end people, designers, marketers, whatever, there's going to be something for you at BlendConf. I guess that's part of the word, huh? It's a blend of different stuff. This is an important bit that may appeal to you. Leave your phones, tablets, whatever, in your bag. Seriously, you won't be able to use them. Each attendee will get a pretty snazzy notebook from the folks at Bound to sketch and their thoughts throughout the session. So it is kind of a enforced, you know, hang out with the people that you're there with kind of thing, which should be pretty cool. We have fantastic folks like Nick Fink, Megan Fisher, James White, Gina Bolton, Cameron Moll, Zoe Gillenwater, Brandon Mathis. Huge lineup. Like I said, 40 speakers. It's all coming to Charlotte, North Carolina, September 5th through 7th. They are at BlendConf on Twitter if you want to just follow along, see what's going on there. You can save 20% off the price of going with the coupon code SHOPTALK. At blendconf.com. It's put on by Berman Painter, who's a super nice guy with an epic mustache and very good designer and developer himself. SaaS guy. I like him.
Yeah.
More questions.
Berman, true fact, Berman invented the mustache. That's true. All right, David Barnes writes in, I'm curious to know what your opinion is on going to college for web development and whether you think it is worth the time and money. I have decided to further my education in my mid-30s, and I'm focused on a bachelor's in web dev. I have learned a lot about web design and development, but it feels like all of the real tangible knowledge I have gained has come from designing websites, doing my own research, and listening to awesome web design podcasts. Thanks for the show, guys.
I brought it. I put it in here because we talked about it last night at dinner, kind of this kind of like, oh, learning programming is so boring. For loops, blah, that's boring. And mostly what you learn is from, you know, just build websites and, you know.
Just build websites!
This question comes up quite a bit, but
Tim might have something to say about it. We just talked about it.
And first of all, are you guys classically trained? Can we put that in quotes?
So I'm going to say the two of us, me and Alex, came from University of South Florida. We took classes in programming, but we weren't like CS majors. That also goes for the three founders of WooFoo. That's where we came from. Like originally, that was our first sort of like software as a service business. And I can say that while the formal education that we did get from school was a decent foundation, I would say that all of us, you know, speaking individually, we took time to learn stuff outside of the classroom. We took as many of the classes as possible, but we also like hacked on our own projects. We worked on stuff all the time. I saw guys around me in the same class who didn't have any sort of these extra projects that they were working on. And I don't know where they are today, but you know, I would say that if you aren't get the education, but if you're not working on something, get started on it, because you need both the like sort of standard educational piece, I guess, but more importantly, you just need to always be working on something.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely feel like if he's at the age where he's 30, and he were to stop his career for, say, 3 to 4 years to get a college degree, I think he would be a little disappointed to come out and find out that the industry has moved ahead 4 years. And I think if you ask me, would I prefer to have 4 years of industry experience versus 4 years of college education for web development, I would much prefer 4 years of industry experience. It's the return is going to be ridiculously high. Plus, student loans just doubled, and you're not going to want to go that route at that point. So I think just building real websites is going to give you the kind of experience, and there's so much information for people who are willing to educate themselves that it would actually be a little detrimental to stop your career and go to school to get the degree at this point.
I think you can. I think he said it himself in the question. Just, I learned a lot about web design and development, but it feels all the real tangible knowledge came from designing websites on my own. Mm-hmm. So I think
school does give you some excuses to work on stuff that you wouldn't normally work on, though. I think so. Sometimes people write into Shop Talk Show and they feel stale because they do client work and they kind of end up repeating the same thing over and over and over, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think there's some, you know, there are some companies that won't even hire you unless you have a bachelor's. So yeah, you should probably, or an associate's or whatever. So like, yeah, you should go and do that, you know, just so you have that, I think. And if you have
it, you learn how to do keg stands and stuff, and that's cool.
I think you got to have freaking a side project or something going on that you are just, you're able to punch ahead, because, you know, in, you know, education tends to move a lot slower than web design. So I think you're going to need some sort of side project or whatever. The chat room is talking about font tags and P align left. So if that gives you any indication on their opinion, but anyway, good luck, David. I hope that helps. Yeah. Chris, did you have anything else you want to?
I don't really. No. I'm like David, you know, continue watching the Shop Talk because these questions seep through, and listen to the archives because we end up talking about this type of stuff kind of all the time. And I'm happy to, because people clearly enjoy it and whatever. Scotty D asks, I'm wondering if anyone has ever had any experience deploying projects with Capistrano. I've been using Beanstalk for deployment, which is great, but I've been wondering if there's something else that could handle deployment of Git repos, a non-paid solution, and it appears that Capistrano might fit the bill. I've installed it, but I haven't really had the time to fully test drive, and I was wondering if anyone had any tips or tricks on the best ways to use it, implement it, love it, hate it, etc. Thanks.
So, I mean, I can definitely talk about this. We use Capistrano extensively at CodePen. You know, when we first started out, we used it straight out of the box, and it pushes your stuff to your servers, and it works great. And over time, we've definitely grown that our deploy.rb, which is like the driver for that Capistrano file, to really be pretty customizable. I mean, at this point, after the deployment, we do a bunch of cool things with permissions and snapshotting of the drives and stuff. You know, Capistrano is definitely the way to go if you're using a Rails project. And then someone asked me about this the other day, and there are you know, Capistrano clones for Python frameworks that work off of Fabric, another language for sysops. So I say, yeah, definitely. Before you roll your own deployment script, definitely get looking into Capistrano, because it works really well out of the box, and then you can also customize it.
This is one of these things that it's in Ruby, but it's just in Ruby. It doesn't matter what your project is in necessarily, right? Or does it? Could you deploy, if you just were willing to install Ruby on your machine, could you deploy a Python project like with Capistrano?
Or static HTML or something?
That I don't know. I mean, I know it does some pretty specific Ruby things out of the box. I don't know if someone's extended it for other languages. I know I was reading about a clone the other day that did something very similar for Python projects, but it was written in Fabric. It was not written in Capistrano.
Wow. Okay.
And what kind of, on a low level, my understanding about what it does is it'll push the files up to a directory in the server, and then like do a symbolic link, like a link to from the old app old to app new. Is that kind of how it works?
That's essentially it. Yeah, you end up with a folder for releases, and that's like the that's like sort of an atomic bundle of like one release, one push. And you're right, it just sort of moves a symbolic link from like one release to the next. There's basically a symlink called current. And current is like what your current project is, and that's where your web app is served out of. It does things like touch the restart.txt file if you're using Fusion Passenger, which means that's going to like automatically restart all of your processes. You know, it gets pretty advanced, but on the base level, yeah, it mostly just gives you a nice structure for your code in production. And because of that, because it's just a symlink, you can do things like rollback really easily. You can say like cap deploy rollback, and it's going to basically move that symlink current from the thing you just pushed to the last thing you pushed. And that's really incredibly helpful if you do something you didn't mean to do.
And then it's kind of like a Git, or it's, you know, it's not exactly based on your Git commits, but like whatever you like, I type in Git commit and then I do cap deploy. And that should push up my latest version, right? Is that's kind of the workflow?
Yeah, that's it. So you've got your branch in there. So you're pushing out of master, and it's going to take whatever's currently at the head of master and push that out to your, push that out to your website.
It is more advanced than Beanstalk, which I think is just FTP based and just replaces files on your system. They probably have some rollbacky stuff in there that will just, you know, also through FTP move the files back to how they were before that push, but it's not quite the same, I don't think. But I've been happy with Beanstalk for my own little personal projects, but what's true about Beanstalk is that the Git repo has to be hosted on Beanstalk, whereas fdeploy or whatever.com works straight up with GitHub or Bitbucket, which I think most people are kind of like having their repo on GitHub, just because GitHub is awesome and stuff, right? You get issues for free, and you just get to use GitHub, which is pleasurable. So that's a alternative for that too.
This is cool. I was in the Capistrano wiki, and they've got like packages for Drupal, Magento, WordPress, PHP.
Yeah, sure. So it can push a PHP project. It is written in Ruby, but it doesn't matter really what your project is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Cool. Well, that sounds easy. I has anyone tried that FTPloy? I'm curious. I know somebody mentioned it when we talked about it before, and people are just like, yep, works. Great. Awesome. It's actually all people from the chat room, like Poopsplat and Awesome Fan. Hey, there you go. That's their like reviews is Shop Talk listeners. There you go. Hey guys, good to see you again. There you go. All right, cool. Do we want to one more or?
Yeah, let's see. Let's see. Let me pick one out here. That second one is really a brain bender. I think we'll save that for another one. Let's do the Carlos Botran one. I have a question about how to develop locally, but also be able to show the client our progress. I'm working with a developer, and we're using GitHub to maintain and sync our work. When I wanted my client to be able to see the website as it progressed, the only solution I found was to be able to set up a publicly available staging site and sync my local version of the site to this staging site. if we make any changes on the staging side, I have to then sync them back down to my local copy. That was red flaggy to me. Then commit that and sync to GitHub. Is there any better way to do this? Work locally, yet have the clients be able to view the website.
So, I mean, there's one thing that we've actually, I've used for testing webhook callbacks. I don't know how well this would work if you were dealing with a large client and lots of people hitting the site, but local tunnel is kind of cool. Local tunnel basically allows you to hit a URL on localtunnel.com, and that sort of forwards the request back to your local host, basically running your website on your computer. That's a pretty cool little tool. But if it's serious work and you don't expect your laptop to be open to serve this stuff up all the time, yeah, you probably want to use a staging server.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might want to set up something like set up a nice branch for your client and maybe deploy that on Heroku, if that's an option.
It could even be like
you.
dev.yoursite.com, right? It could just be a subdomain.
Yeah, definitely. So just making something available to your client once in a while would be pretty interesting. Like, you could definitely take a specific branch and deploy it to Heroku and just have them view that.
The
red flag sentence was I wanted my client to be able to see it. And the only solution I found was to set up publicly available staging site, then sync my local version of the site to this staging site. If we make any changes to the staging site, then I have to sync them back down to my local copy. That's what seemed weird to me.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't be working on the staging site to begin with. You should probably just push changes up from your local development environment to staging, not the other way around.
Right. Never work on staging. Always work in version control.
So that seems weird.
Yeah, I would just, when you're pushing things to staging.
Unless he means database-y, I want to show my client this WordPress blog that I've created for them. And they're like, cool, I like it. Let me play around with it for a minute. And they go into the WP admin and they publish a new post or something. And then you're like, oh, crap. I got to grab that database stuff and sync it back down. Maybe that's what they mean because they weren't super specific about it. So in that case, there is that WordPress plugin that we've talked about on the show before, that WP something DB Migrate Pro, which we use in so that could work for that if you're specifically talking about database stuff. But in general, I would treat staging as pretty sacred, just like you would master. You don't work on master and then sync it back down,
Mm-hmm. I wonder if he's maybe also hot fixing. on the phone, they're like, move that 3 pixels. And he's like, yes, sir. And which that can happen. That's a real use case, right? But try to avoid that. I don't know if you can. Just be like, yeah, I'm taking notes, copious notes. Right. I'll do that. That might be a thing. Just trucking that out there. Anyway.
Pretty good, though. So
I use a paid version of Local Tunnel. Maybe I should switch. Called forwardhq.com, and it's the same deal, but it's just you can get your own subdomain, and you can change your subdomain to whatever you want on the fly. Or I pay for a reserved namespace. So
that's not a bad idea, considering I've worked with Local Tunnel before, and they do port forwarding. So you're basically. You may be getting other people's requests who have shut down their local tunnel, and you're serving on their subdomain. So it's a little, local tunnel is great for sort of one-off-y stuff. But yeah, I'd probably pay for something if you were gonna continually show it out of the same subdomain, for example.
And when I say pay, it's $5. Right. But yeah. it's been the thing about local tunneling is you're kind of. You're at the whim of the wind, basically, how fast the network is and your network and their network. And so it just ends up being, I've had it be real slow lately. So I think that's just kind of part of, hacking into your machine kind of. So I don't know. I recommend it. We use it for clients all the time, and you can just be like, this will be up for 1 hour. So go check it out and let me know. And then you're getting feedback within an hour, which is unheard of in the client services business. So there you go. Try that. So, all right. Well, I think I think we'll have to cut it off here. But guys, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us on here. It's been a lot of fun.
I know I speak for everyone in Shop Talk world. Thanks so much for CodePen and all the work you guys do. But how can people follow you guys, give you money, tweet you? How does that work?
If you want to follow us, follow at CodePen. You can follow me, Alex Vasquez, if you like really stupid jokes on Twitter.
Hold on, stop show. Stupid jokes? Do you have one? If you're holding.
My goal is to submit a web joke that okay. is read on the Shop Talk show. But
all right,
still crafting it, Dave. Still crafting it.
Oh, believe me, I'll waste a day or two thinking about puns. But anyway, okay, so follow you for web jokes at Alex Vasquez. Is that right?
Alex Quez on Twitter. If you really want to follow us, go to CodePen.io, create an account, create cool stuff. That's the best way.
Cool. Tim?
You can follow us on CodePen, obviously. I write some like really extremely nerdy stuff on boomboomboom.biz. You guys should check that out too. Otherwise, yeah, just use CodePen. That's the best way to follow us. We'll alert you in app of new things that are happening.
Yeah. Oh, it's every week you guys are shipping new features. It's awesome.
The idea. Cool. Yep.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for listening, tuning in to the live listeners. Thank you guys, and be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter because we tend to change the day that we broadcast, and then we also there's holidays and stuff. But then be sure to buy stuff on the store, and you know, do a solid and rate us in iTunes so people can find the show. And Chris, you got anything else?
Yeah, ShopTalkShow.com.
Oops, wrong button.